You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome to Extinction Rebellion Radio. We are thrilled to have on our show today Ben Tippett, author of the book Split Class Divides Uncovered, which was published this past March by Pluto Press. Now, we will be talking to him about his article called Burning Injustice, Why the California Wildfires Are a Class Crisis, which was recently published in Open Democracy. But we'll give him a chance in the show to talk about his really, really important book. Ben is getting his PhD in wealth inequality. We're so glad to have you. You write in this article, Burning Injustice, that the climate crisis is a class crisis. Can you explain to the listeners what you mean by that?
So I could discuss this maybe in the example of the Californian wildfires. As you could probably hear from my accent, I'm not from California. I live in London. So I only see these things from an outsider's perspective. And so, yeah, why did I focus on this as the story of class and climate change? I think the first reason is that, you know, I think forest fires, firstly, they're an issue that aren't going to go away. So when I wrote the book, I was talking about the 2018 forest fires, which at the time were the biggest forest fires that California had experienced. And obviously this year we saw those records being broken again. You know, not just the records of fire. We saw in the Death Valley, the hottest, most reliably recorded temperature ever recorded on Earth. So I think part of the thing is that what you have with fires is we often talk about climate change in such like marginal and precise terms, you know, 1.5 degrees of warming. And what's interesting about a forest fire is it really shows the very viscerally the fact that the planet is warming and is becoming deeply uninhabitable, and will wreck people's lives and people's livelihoods. So there's that thing, you know, I think it's a powerful allegory for a century that will be defined by warming. The second thing is that there was this story that that I read about, which was about Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. So they have this, $60 million mansion in the Hidden Hills, just in a kind of almost privatized celebrity hangout in, I think just outside of Los Angeles. And, you know, they live there. You also have Miley Cyrus, Britney Spears, The Weeknd. And there was this story that happened in the Californian firefighters of 2018, which is that they basically had to, evacuate their home. And then it turned out that over time, what had actually happened is they had hired private firefighters.
We were fortunate enough and blessed enough, and I know that not everyone has this luxury available to them, but we were able to get private firefighters, a company that you can hire, that friends of mine that lost their home in a Santa Barbara fire, all their neighbors used this company.
Right.
And so they recommended the company. And because of them, they saved our home and saved our neighborhood.
The neighborhood as well.
I had them, you know, just make sure that they controlled every house on the edge. So it wasn't just my home that I said, just take care of our home, take care of everything. Because once they go, you know, once ours starts, the whole neighborhood can go.
We don't have red trucks. We don't drive down the street and it doesn't scream fire to the public. When they see us pull into their homes, and they see us prepping these houses in the areas, you know, I'm sure they got a lot of questions like, why are you only going to that house? Well, they have a policy with an insurance company that we're contracted by.
Now, I'd never really heard of the concept of private firefighters before. Firefighting, like, you know, the police and this kind of stuff seem to be one of the central functioning bodies of the state. And so I kind of wanted to look in a little bit to these private firefighter services and particularly the one that they were using. And there were some questions that kind of came up, you know, who was providing these things? Why did they need to rely on private firefighters in the first place? So in terms of that second question, the actual money that's going into private sources, private funding for fighting fires in the US is huge. According to, you know, one of the lobby groups for one of these private firefighting companies, it's as much as 40 percent of the money that's invested in fighting fires comes from private sources. The second kind of interesting thing I found was that one of the big companies that did this was a company called AIG, which is an insurance company. And they're one of their bespoke kind of firefighting services was they claim as well as being taken up by nearly half of the Forbes 400 richest Americans. And AIG is an interesting case because it's one of the companies that was at the center of the 2008 financial crisis. It basically developed these quite toxic insurance products. If you've seen, I don't know, any of the films like The Big Short or something, you'd have come across it. But it basically was one of they're these things called CDSs, credit default swaps. And it was at the center, you know, one of the instruments they created that really blew up the global economy in 2008. And they were bailed out to the tune of around $180 billion.
The U.S. government's announced its second major financial bailout this month, agreeing to take over the troubled insurance giant American International Group, or AIG. At an $85 billion cost, the New York Times calls it the most radical intervention in private business in the central bank's history. The AIG bailout comes just weeks after the government takeover of the federally chartered mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And it just got me thinking, well, on the one hand, you have this company that's providing this kind of state function to some of the richest people in the world while also being given public money. And then when you compare that to the fact that really over time, the state funding for firefighting has massively declined. And part of that is the result of kind of neoliberal ideology where we say, we need pro-corporate and pro-market solutions to our problems. And so it's a kind of an idea that if the private sector comes in, it will be more efficient. So, this is really interesting, but it was really the last thing about the story that I think kind of gives the dystopian part of it, which is the fact that, and I had no idea that this was happening before, but so much of the Californian firefighters are actually prisoners. Maybe it's a much bigger, I'd be interested to know if it's a really big story in California.
There has been a lot of pushback around making sure that they are given more wages and that when they get out that they can actually work as firefighters. So there's been a lot of pushback around the use of prison labor in California.
Yeah, because this is the interesting thing, and obviously all these issues are very complicated. But one of the shocking things is the fact that these prison firefighting laborers were being paid around $1 an hour in order to do this stuff. And a lot of them were very, very willing to do that because, of course, if you're imprisoned and somebody gives you an opportunity to do something that's valuable for society and where you get to, just not sit in your cell, people are going to massively take up that opportunity. And it just felt... Really, you had the coming together of all of these different stories of class. On the one hand, the kind of neoliberal story of reducing state funding for certain types of state activities. While on the other hand, as I guess you guys know as well, is that in California, you see this mass increase in incarceration rates. Over, I think since from the 1970s to today, you've seen, incarceration rates increased by hundreds and hundreds of percent. There's now more women in prison in California alone than there were women in prison in the whole of the United States in 1970.
Tanzilia Luciano ran into an inmate crew in Calistoga earlier this week as they were helping fight the Tubbs fire.
So we just came across one of only three camps that are actually probably the only female camp working out here.
Last night, we were driving all night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we got in.
Oh,
yeah.
What have you been doing?
So really, there's this kind of this sense that, you know, we've created the conditions by which people are willing to, you know, but the rich can effectively pay for protection because, but like from companies that are themselves being propped up by taxpayers' money at the same time that the taxpayer can't rely on public services to protect themselves. And so what they have to basically rely on a growing prison population that are willing to risk their lives for a dollar a day.
So it may be obvious to listeners, but it's worth dwelling for a moment on what the reality of firefighting working conditions are. These are life-threatening jobs, are they not? And very dangerous jobs at times. They're private firefighting companies hired, for example, by celebrities or other very rich individuals, staffed, so to speak, by prisoners who are being almost rented to them for this labor for at the rate of a dollar a day from public prisons as well as private prisons. Are they all coming from private prisons or are they coming from a mixture?
I think in terms of the private firefighters, I don't know if the prison inmate labor is so much going towards that. What I know is that it's definitely going towards the state firefighting service. So the state is kind of relying on this prison labor, this kind of ballooning incarcerated population in order to provide basic fundamental state services. So I think, you know, and the amount of money that's being saved by paying such low wages compared to what you would need to pay actual, you know, firefighters is, you know, it's a lot, but it's definitely not as much as AIG were given in terms of the bailout for sure.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. You're listening in on our conversation with Benjamin Tippett on the climate crisis as a class crisis.
You can see from these primitive videos, humankind didn't really know that they were getting close to the events that would cause their extinction because they were distracted by so many new inventions. And who could blame them? They rode in self-driving cars using virtual reality goggles to fly to Mars. While on Earth, the dirt and air were getting kind of strange, full of plastic and smoke causing global climate change.
7 out of 10 of the countries most affected by climate change are in sub-Saharan Africa. The climate crisis is a racist crisis. Environmental racism means that black people in Britain are 28% more likely to be exposed to air pollution than their white counterparts. Climate crisis is a racist crisis.
So 4 years ago, Black Lives Matter UK articulated the idea, which got quite a lot of pushback, that the climate crisis is a racist crisis. And in many ways, that's what you argue in this piece. And yet your focus is on class.
So it's interesting you bring this up because I was actually partly involved in the action, the BLM action. The action was it was shutting down a runway in London City Airport, which is this kind of small airport in the east of London. And the actual airport is situated in a county called, or basically like a district of London called Newham. And the airport itself, though, serves very much this financial sector of the city. So, you know, I think the average salary of somebody who was using the airport was something like £130,000. While though, you know, over 40% of the people that live in Newham, where the airport is, struggle to live on, you know, £20,000 a year. And so you had this very clear class divide between those who were using the airport and those who had to suffer the pollution of the airport on a very, you know, micro level. And the other thing to mention really is that Newham isn't just one of the poorest districts in London. It's also one of the most multicultural, most diverse, districts in the whole of the UK. And it really shows the interrelationship really between class and race, and the way in which this maps onto the climate crisis. Our aim with the action was to really expose, I think, the fact that the climate crisis isn't this just, it's not something that's just about polar bears in the Arctic or about, you know, WWF, like trying to protect tigers in India. Really, like, it's a fundamental result of the inequalities that exist within capitalism, and particularly this relationship between class and race. And it exists on the micro level. So I think maybe to just to kind of reiterate what one of the points of the action was, it was really to show that local pollution is both a race and class issue. And this has been borne out by the data. Basically, if you're a black British, African person, living in the UK, you're much more exposed to higher levels of pollutants than if you're an urban white person. And why is this? Well, it's because of the fact that it's not a biological thing. This is because of the racial and the way in which race and class intersects in the UK. You know, these people tend to be living, in the most, deprived parts of the city, tend to be near roads, tend to be near airports. And there's, I guess, like two things this year that have really brought this out in even more depth. One is obviously the COVID crisis, but the other one is that there was actually a really, there was a landmark case that was just, came to a head a few days ago with this, young girl called Ella Roberta. She was a 7-year-old that, tragically, died, of, she had asthma, and basically she was living in quite near to Newham, in London, in a neighboring place called, Lewisham. And what the case did was it basically was fighting to put air pollution as the cause of death on Ella's death certificate. And they won that case recently. And it really kind of, I think, exposed the fact that, you know, race, class, and literally, you know, the quality of the air that you breathe, are deeply interrelated. Like, it's interesting because when we did the action, the response was pretty kind of, critical. You know, there was, the press on the one hand, you know, said stuff like, how can the weather be racist? This is ridiculous. There were also lots of people on the left who criticized it because of the fact that the protesters, were white, even though it was organized with Black Lives Matter, UK. And so it's, I don't know. On the one hand, I'd like to think that it brought this issue of how the climate crisis is racialized and how that relates to class to kind of a national and if you guys heard about it as well, I guess like a global audience. I mean, Stuart Hall, the British race academic, had this repeated line, but I think it's good, which is that race is the modality in which classes live. One of the things that happened with Extinction Rebellion here in London, or in the UK, is that there was some divides around race. You know, one of the central organizing principles or central ideas of Extinction Rebellion is you can kind of subvert the state apparatus. You can subvert the police system in a way that puts a lot of pressure on it to create mass civil disobedience. And the way in which you do that is it's kind of, as you guys know, you know, you voluntarily get arrested for small crimes like, blocking roads. And this creates the conditions to do things like have a festival in the street. You know, because if a lot of people are getting, you know, if you have thousands of people who are getting arrested on a bridge, then you can turn the bridge into a garden, which is what they did in London, or you can turn the middle of one of the busiest shopping streets into a DJ set on a boat. And on the one hand, that was really interesting, you know, a really interesting tactic to which we had never really seen before. The police didn't know how to respond to it. And it really created huge impacts in British, on the way in which we think about climate change in the UK. But then on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are criticizing this. And I think, again, it's true, that this really wasn't accessible for a lot of black communities, or, you know, who the police have effectively criminalized and terrorized these communities for a long period of time, and have murdered family members and friends within these communities for a long period of time. So when they saw this kind of, you know, firstly, there was a fear about being arrested, but there was also some of the language that Extinction Rebellion was were using around loving the police and this kind of stuff. They saw it as, you know, a white person's movement. So in this sense, you know, there has to be a way in which the environmental movement doesn't reproduce that kind of logics of, I guess, like racism, or that kind of further to divide the environmental movement. Because I think part of the problem which we see now in the UK is that the environmental movement is considered to be a white, at least it's presented as a white middle class issue, even though you have cases like Ellers, or you have the people living in Newham, or you have the fact that the Global South on the front line of this crisis, or, you know, the Bangladesh at the time of the Californian wildfires, was a third of its country was underwater, and you have a massive Bangladeshi immigrant population or, you know, in the UK. So I think trying to get out of that politics is a hard one. Trying to kind of create spaces that are accessible to people is very hard. But I think it's definitely a part of what needs to be done.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Elise Lane and Matt Kearney. We're in conversation with Ben Tippett, author of the article Burning Injustice, Why the California Wildfires Our Class Crisis. It's time to wake up, it's time to wake up, wake up. It's time to wake up, it's time to wake up, wake up. It's time to wake up, it's time to wake up before mankind and Mother Earth break up.
Should we foresee the climate crisis as changing the class structure in major ways? Or perhaps we should say the intersectional race class structure?
There's some long-term economic changes around the climate that I think are going to change the way that we think about the issue. I mean, one big one is the fact that over the coming decades, it's going to be countries in the global south that are the ones that are producing the most CO2. You know, the global north will, I think, increasingly start to decarbonize its economy. And countries in the global south will be entering into a kind of sustained period of economic growth that, in order to increase, you know, GDP per capita, which is very much a central policy aim of most of these countries, not all of them, but a lot of them, because they see it as a way to alleviate poverty and to, you know, increase the material benefits and conditions of the people that live there. So that's one of it. I think the other thing is the right, I think, are going to try and politicize climate change along a culture war. So they're going to try and create this idea that climate policies are only benefiting a metropolitan elite. They don't benefit ordinary people. And as climate change will become a more salient political issue on the doorstep for national politics, I think there could be an opening for the right, for parts of the kind of far right to really be pushing this and to be pushing, you know, this idea that it's an elite project. And I think, you know, again, what we need to be doing on the left or with Extinction Rebellion or as climate activists is really thinking of narratives in order to fight that. I mean, one way to do that is do something like the Green New Deal, in which you tie fighting climate change to providing public services for people, as you tie it kind of more towards a collective program. So yeah, they're the two kind of big ways in which I see it.
Ben, you have a new book out, like we mentioned in the very beginnings. It's called Split Class Divides Uncovered, and it was published in March by Pluto Press. Tell listeners what it is about and where they can get it.
So the book aims to tell an accessible story of economic inequality and how class relates to so many parts of our life, you know, work, race, gender, the environment, housing, the government. Is part of this series with Pluto Press, and you can order the book via their website, Pluto Press.
I am sure that it is fascinating and will point us in some really good directions for moving forward and the work we have to do. Well, thank you so much, Ben. It's been a pleasure. You have been listening to Ben Tippett. Ben, have a wonderful day and thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Lisa and Matt, for having me on the show. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
WBAI listeners and supporters.
Tune in Tuesday, February 23rd
from 7 to 9 p.m.
for the first report of 2021
from the WBAI Local Station Board.
This month, you'll be introduced to the LSB officers and to the PNB directors.
They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI.
So, mark that date on your calendar. Tuesday, February 23rd, 7 to 9 p.m. The first report of 2021 from the WBAI Local Station Board.
Only on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org.
Nuclear reactor north of New York City shuts down in April, but then decommissioning starts.
Indian Point's owner plans to transfer the license to Holtec.
Some environmental groups and elected officials oppose this because of Holtec's long-standing disregard of health and safety.
Holtec continues to be investigated for corruption and cutting corners.
Ken, Sally, and Donna from Ecologic ask you. Comment by Friday, February 26th.
For talking points and how to send your comments, go to www.clearwater.org.
That's clearwater.org.
Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
Listen to me.
Hello, my fierce and beautiful people. I'm Johanna Fernandez, host of WBAI's morning show, A New Day. One of our listeners donated in the name of Little Red Riding Hood recently. That's because here at WBAI, the wolf is nipping at our heels. We are truly listener-sponsored non-commercial radio. We are depending on you to keep the wolf at bay and the station operating. So here's the thing. We'd love to have you donate in the name of Red Riding Hood. That's the Little Red Riding Hood plan for $25. And you'll get a full year's membership in the 60-year experiment in community radio. You know the drill. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Or go to give the number 2WBAI.org. Give the number 2WBAI.org and say your Little Red Riding Hood determined to keep the wolf at bay.
Program was Extinction Rebellion, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. Stay tuned for a report to the listener from the WBAI Radio Committee that's coming up in the next, actually in mere minute, in mere seconds, I should say, in mere seconds, that's coming up. And while the program is on the air and while the report is being presented, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602, or go to W. Wait.